not, then let's press on. So we're doing three fields, and I'm beating you over the head with canonical normalization a little bit. But one of the problems in the problem set asks you to write down the most general or normalizable interaction under some circumstances. Use canonical normalization, first thing. And the second thing is renormalizable for the purposes of that assignment and for the purposes of most things we do until we actually get to renormalizability. Just means you want all the couplings to on dimensional grounds be a non-negative power of mass in units where h bar and c are 1. And I'll say more about that later today, but that's what that means. So don't think you have to go and prove that the theory is normalizable in the way that you'll see in a textbook. And so last class we kind of flogged to death the n scalar fields. I didn't say it, but I should have said it, that if you have n spinless particles, there's no loss of generality in using real scalar fields to describe them, because if you had complex fields, you could take the real imaginary parts. And so it's useful to use real fields just because that's the general statement. If you had an odd number of real fields, you'll never describe that in terms of complex fields. Complex fields are, as a rule, useful if you have symmetries, and because the symmetries can sometimes be phrased as phase rotations of the complex fields. And so if you have a symmetry like that, then it's worth your while to write things in terms of complex fields, but generically not otherwise. And the same set of words applies for spin a half particles too, although that's something which is probably less familiar. And so the statement is that if you have, there's no loss of generality in describing spin a half particles using the analog of real fields, which are Majorana fields. But it's useful to use complex fields, which is what we call Dirac fields, when you have a symmetry such as a phase symmetry, like electric charge conservation symmetries. And it typically in quantum electrodynamics, the simplest examples you see involve fermions that are electrically charged, and because they're charged, there is a symmetry like that, and so you do things in terms of complex spinners, but that's not the general case. And so here I want to do the general case, and so I'm going to use a basis of real fields, and then later on we'll combine things into complex spinners when we need to. So let me warm that up with, let me ask you, I guess, who's happy with what a Majorana spinner is, or a Weyl spinner is, say? So there's a tentative hands. It sounds like you're kind of happy at that level. Is that? And I can't see you very well in Guelph, but are you, you're happy with?
I'm happy, yeah.
All right. So I'll do a kind of a whirlwind summary, and I'm more or less working out of the book. But you know, you're used to the idea that Dirac spinners, so spin a half particles are being represented by Dirac spinners. How do you want to say this? So we have some sort of a sum over spins, integral over momenta. As usual, then there's a coefficient, and there's a convention here which I always remember wrongly. Yeah. Okay. So you remember? Let me do the scalar one first, and then so you can see kind of what I'm doing differently, because it's really not. So you remember, for scalar fields we had 5x was integral d3p over square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy times destruction operator times e to the I dx plus then the complex conjugate. So this was the particle part, this was the antiparticle part, and there was a song and dance of you need them both because you want this thing to commute with itself. Yada, yada, yada. The 2e here is kind of required because I'm using states for which momentum normalization is just the usual delta function one and not a relativistic one. So in the standard model book, I use a, Guy and I used a covariant choice here for which there's factors of the square root of 2e on the right-hand side, and that changes the normalizations a little bit. That's the only real difference between this and the book. For spin and half particles, then, there's a similar story. You'd have, so I'm thinking here psi is a I'm running it as a column vector, so it's like psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4 in Dirac spinner space. So you're thinking of Dirac spinners or spinners as being four component objects, the way you normally see them first time. And that would have a similar description in terms of sums over spins and integral over momenta. And I'm not going to write the 2e here because I'm going to absorb it into the next thing here. So we'll have something, a wave function, if you like, which depends on momentum and spin. And this carries the Dirac index. So if I call psi I, if I is the thing that goes from 1 to 4, then u will be the thing that carries that index. Then there's a destruction operator, e to the I px. And here, e to the I px, that's code for e to the I p mu x mu. And then there's a similar thing involving the antiparticle, which has a similar spinner, vi p sigma a star p sigma. And this doesn't have to be the same particle, so that could have been the antiparticle, e to the minus I. And more or less, the story of psi would be real if the particle is equal to its antiparticle. So phi equals phi star would go with a p sigma being equal to a bar p sigma. But if you had a complex field, then the particle and the antiparticle would be different. So this would create and destroy a different particle, and they'd be distinguished by their charges. Similar story here. So here I could have had the same particle or not, and that's the issue as to, so there's two separate issues. One is, in the same sense that for scalar fields, there's a mathematical, you can mathematically decide if a field's real or not without knowing anything about particles. And on the particle side of the story, the real fields, one real field is useful for describing a particle which is equal to its antiparticle. So the physical issue is a particle equal to its antiparticle? And if it is, then the useful field to describe it with is a real field. And the same thing's true for spin and half particles, that the physics issue is the particle just different from its antiparticle? And if it is, that particle is called a Majorana particle. And then there's an abusive notation where, so if you do have a particle that's equal to its antiparticle, it's useful to describe it in terms of a Majorana field, which is the analog of a real field. And Majorana is being used in two different senses there, that the particle being equal to its antiparticle is a Majorana particle, and the spinner being real means it's a Majorana spinner. So when Majorana is an adjective for a spinner, it's a mathematical statement about reality, like it would have been for real fields, whereas it applies to particles, it's talking about whether the particles and antiparticles are different from one another. And so I labor that because the statement I'm making is that there's no loss of generality in using real fields. So you can always use Majorana fields to describe particles, even if they're different from the antiparticles. In the same way that I can take a complex field describing a scalar particle that's different from its antiparticle, and I can write it in terms of its real and imaginary parts if I want to. So there's no physical assumptions in saying I'm using Majorana spinners, which you might have thought there were, because there is a physical assumption if I were to tell you that all particles were equal to their antiparticles. And so, so I want to just separate those issues. So reality for spinners. So I guess the defining property of this thing is that under Lorentz transformations, have that the spinner goes transformed into, there's a bunch of generators for Lorentz transformations, which are normally written as an anisometric tensor, which I'm not sure. Are you all happy if I write this? So if I write out the transformation rule for a spinner under Lorentz transformations, has this form where these are a bunch of parameters, six of them because omega is anti-symmetric. So a 4x4 anti-symmetric matrix has six things in it. So there's six Lorentz transformation parameters. And these are a bunch of matrices that go with them. Are you happy with the, so the first class I asked if people were happy with the Lorentz group and representations. And everybody said they were. So you can still stop me now. So are you all happy with this? So what I have here is that these are the generators of Lorentz transformations. There'll be six of them. Three of them correspond to rotations in space, and three of them correspond to boosts. So they're labeled by velocities. And when you decide that a field is transforming in a bigger way, what you're really doing is deciding what these matrices are. And for fields, you're always looking for finite dimensional matrices, and this will be the commutator to gamma matrices or something like that. But the important thing is, for the purposes of what I want to say next, is that these matrices, if I write them out, I write J, so the rotations in here will be the ones where mu and nu are both space. So if I write A, Jij as being, you know, epsilon ijk jk, where this is the completely anisymmetric symbol. That just says that a 3x3 anisymmetric matrix has three elements to it, and you can write them as a vector. And if I write J0i as being ki, then one way of writing these six independent generators is to look at these ones, which are the ones that describe rotations. And these are the ones that correspond to boosts, because it's time space. So boosts are things that change the Lorentz frame between, change the velocity of the observers that are related by the Lorentz transformation. Now, the important thing about these matrices is, let me just write them out for you explicitly once, is that they're diagonal. They're block diagonal in this 4x4 spinner space. And there's a song and dance that goes behind that, which I wasn't going to repeat unless people want me to. So if you explicitly write these out, so Ji is the matrix 1/2 Pauli matrix I, 0, 0, 1/2 Pauli matrix I. So these are all 2x2 blocks. And then the boosts are represented by minus I over 2 Pauli matrix I, 0, 0. I is a bad choice. Let me use J here. I over 2 Pauli matrix J. So the main thing is that they're block diagonal. So there's no Lorentz transformation that takes the bottom two components and mixes it with the top two components. And that means that we're really carrying around too many components. That you only needed half of these things to describe a Lorentz transformation properly. And this is really a reducible representation, the one that Dirac wrote down. And so it's like carrying twins around everywhere that, you know, you don't really need the second one if you had the first one. And so that means that there has to be a Lorentz invariant. It's a Lorentz invariant thing to I could set the bottom two components to zero, and that's a Lorentz invariant statement, because if I set them to zero, these transformations won't ruin that property. And same thing, if I set the top two to zero, then transformations won't ruin that property. And so that shows that. So this shows that these are reducible. And so a Weyl spinner are the ones where you reduce things by setting these guys to zero or these guys to zero. So psi 1, psi 2, 0, 0 is what we were going to call a left-handed spinner. 0, 0, psi 3, psi 4. I call it a right-handed spinner. Right-handed Weyl spinner. And you remember that we had a gamma 5 matrix that I defined in terms of the, I think it was I times gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. And that had, that was 0, 0, minus 1 in block diagonal form. And so these two things are distinguished by their eigenvalue of this matrix. So, gamma 5, so if I call this thing psi left, if you like, and I call this thing psi right, and gamma 5 on psi left is equal to psi left. Gamma 5 on psi right is equal to minus psi right. And a projector which picks out these pieces, so psi left is 1 half 1 plus gamma 5 on some generic psi, and psi right would be 1 half 1 minus gamma 5 generic psi. And this is what I'm going to call everywhere gamma left. This is what I will call gamma right. And it's because it's a projection operator. Right, this is just 1, 0, 0, 0, and this is 0, 0, 0, 1. So they both satisfy gamma left squared is equal to gamma left, gamma right squared is equal to gamma right, and gamma left, gamma right is equal to 0. So one way you can always proceed is you can always talk about vial spinners like that. But another way you can proceed, So the Majorana way of proceeding is to, instead of saying this guy is zero, is you could say this guy, these two guys are the complex conjugates of these two guys. And that makes sense because you can see that the, from these matrices, basically that the transformation rules, if the transformation rules for the right-handed spinners under Lorentz transformations are the complex conjugates of the transformation rules of the left-handed guys up to a matrix. So if you this Pauli matrix identity is just that sigma k complex conjugate is equal to e sigma k e, where e is just I sigma 2 and it's just the anisometric matrix, 0, 1, and minus 1, 0. Such is an identity for all the Pauli matrices, which you can check yourself if you like. That shows you that if say psi is a left-handed spinner, so it transforms like the upper two components of psi, then E psi star is a right-handed spinner, or E is the same E. So it's not. So given that these transformation rules involve Pauli matrices, that allows you to conclude this. And so that means that a Lorentz invariant thing to say, rather than these things are zero, another way to remove 2 degrees of freedom here is to say, well, we'll just make these guys be the complex conjugate of these guys with that matrix in there. So a Majorana spinner, or, kind of, you'd write this as being, say, psi and then E psi star. That's a Lorentz invariant thing to do because they transform the right way and the representation was reducible. Because this bottom guy is the complex conjugate of the top guy up to this matrix. So another way of saying that is, I'm going to say that psi satisfies that psi is equal to some matrix times itself, whereas this matrix is, I'm going to get this right, I probably won't get this right, let me just tell you what my conventions are here. So E, the reason you call it not real, or real in quotes, is that it's real up to a matrix transformation. And so that's what Majorana means. Often we use the quantity psi bar is something which transforms you've seen before since you've seen spinners. That's, in my notation, something which is psi dagger times a matrix. that matrix is, I'm going to call it beta. So beta is 0, 1, 1, 0. But it's also, that's equal to I gamma 0. I gamma 0. If I'm doing that right. It makes a difference for me whether the 0 is up or down, you remember, because my metric has got the minus sign and the time component. So let me make sure I don't lie to you on that. I gamma up is 0, right? So for Majorana spinners, this will be related to the transpose of psi because there's a reality condition. So for Majorana spinners. Psi bar can be written as psi transpose times a matrix, which I'm going to call epsilon gamma 5. Gamma 5, you already know. It's there. And epsilon is the matrix. E zero zero E. Excuse me. So those are my spinner conventions. And I can come back to what the spinners U and V are later, probably, but we don't need it right now. So this is just kind of defining our terms. So if we have a bunch of spin a half particles, in the same sense that there's no loss of generality describing spin zero particles in terms of real fields, because you can always take the real and imaginary parts of whatever field you used, here you're equally allowed to always write your fields in terms of Majorana fermions. And it's just kind of six of one half dozen of the other, whether you alternatively, you could also write things in terms of left-handed fields. And you can take any right-handed fields and complex conjugate them and call them left-handed fields. And it's really a matter of definition, because in that language, we're agreeing on what the left-handed piece is, and then it's just a question of what you're carrying around as the right-handed part of your spinner. And the relevant merits of using, there's no moral high ground here. It's just a question of what's convenient for writing your Lagrangian down. So what I'd like to do now is, with Majorana spinners, just repeat what we did last time, just because it's a little bit different for the fermions. But the upshot is the same. So what we want to do is, for free spin a half particles, for n of them, we want to write down the most general quadratic thing we can write involving these things, for which the Lagrangian is a real Lorentz scalar, and then use all our freedom to redefine fields to put it into canonical form. And the answer will be the same as it was before, that the canonical form is characterized just by the masses of the particles and the vacuum energy. And so that's kind of where we're going now. I don't know if you ever got a chance to sign this. But if you could, that'd be great. All right, so let's start off with what's the most general thing we can start off with. So we have to write down the most general free spin a half run or n. So we'll have a bunch of fields. We'll call it, say, psi A, where A goes from 1 to n. And all these will be Majorana in the sense we just described. What can we do? We can write down things involving, excuse me. We want to write down things involving no derivatives, and then things involving the fewest number of derivatives, and the stuff.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Sorry. The camera wasn't following you.
Is it now, or is it?
Yeah, it's good now.
Okay. All right. So what do we have? We have to build. So the challenge is, how do you build Lorentz scalars out of psi? We don't have the option of doing things linearly in psi anymore. We can always write something involving nothing, no size, like before, the constant. Let me do that last, though, because I think in my notation before, that was the last thing I wrote down. If we want to make a scalar out of psi, we can. We need at least two of them. And so I guess before I write this down, we should talk about what the bilinears are of psi. So if we have two spinners and combine them, there's a bunch of tensors you can get. And the gamma matrices are kind of designed to give you the combinations of pairs of psi which transform in simple ways as either vectors or as scalars under Lorentz transformation. So let me just remind you of that. So bilinears. So if you take psi bar matrix psi, this is in general a 4x4 matrix. So that's 16 numbers in that 4x4 matrix. A useful basis of this 4x4 matrix space is given by the gamma matrices. So it's a 16-dimensional space. And this has a basis which I can take to be 1, gamma 5, gamma mu, gamma 5, and gamma mu nu, which is the 1/2 the commutator of gamma mu and gamma nu. So here we have one matrix, another one. This is four matrices because mu goes from 0, 1, 2, 3. This is another 4. So altogether we've got 8, 9, 10. And then there's 6 of them here because this is anisymmetric. So that's 16 matrices. So the statement is I can write any matrix, any complex matrix can be written as, A times 1 plus B times gamma 5 plus C mu times gamma mu plus D mu times gamma mu gamma 5 plus E mu nu times gamma mu nu. And one way to prove that these are linearly independent matrices is that there's an inner product, there's a natural inner product in the space of matrices, which is the trace of matrix. We use inner product MN, we call that trace of M star N, M dagger N probably is what I want to do. Then with this inner product, these things are all orthogonal. So the trace of this times this is 0. Trace of any pair of these things with each other is 0. So they have to be linearly independent. Given that they're not the same matrix, they're all orthogonal in this space. So it's sufficient to tell you how psi 1, psi 2, transforms the Lorentz transformations for this basis, rather than taking an arbitrary matrix. And of course, that basis is chosen because the bilinears involving the basis matrices do transform in an obvious way, and the indices are basically the notation is your friend. It's telling you how these things transform. So psi bar 1, psi bar 2, or psi 2 transforms as a scalar under Lorentz transformations. R1 gamma 5 psi 2 transforms as a pseudoscalar. Psi bar 1 gamma mu psi 2 transforms as a 4 vector. Transforms as an axial. R1 gamma mu nu psi 2 transforms as an anti-symmetric tensor. And it's anti-symmetric? Yeah, anti-symmetric tensor. So that's purely group theory, right? If you know how these things separately transform under Lorentz transformations. You combine them, you're doing the classic Clebsch-Gordan thing. you've got some reducible thing, you're reducing it under Lorentz transformations, and this is telling you how it divides up. So for rotations, two spin a half things would have given you a spin one and a spin zero. And this is just telling you the Lorentz version of that for two direct spinners. All right, so now it's much easier to try and build Lagrangians if we know how things transform, because the Lagrangian has to be a Lorentz scalar. There's another board here somewhere, right? This is the board. So what we'll do is the two obvious ones, I guess, are these guys here. These are scalars. Pseudoscalar just means that it changes sign under parity compared to this one, and the same thing, axial vector changes sign compared to that one under parity. But parity, you know, nothing says that parity has to be a symmetry. So what we could have here is we could have A, maybe sidebar A, B. B. So those are things that are Lorentz invariant, because this is transforming like a scalar. You probably want to have a conventional line assigned there, because if that's the way things are going to work out. We could also make two things that are vectors. So that's not so good, because that's something which is not a Lorentz invariant. But we want a derivative in the Lagrangian too, so we can combine those vectors with derivatives to write things like CAB, phi bar A, and mu, B mu, phi B. So we have minus CAB, phi bar A, and mu, gamma 5, mu, phi B. We could have a constant. We could have things with derivatives in different places. But I can always integrate them by parts and do the same story as I did for the scalars and write them in terms of these ones. So we're basically done here, if we're only allowed to make things with derivatives and those bilinears. We didn't use the tensor, but the tensor, we have to contract the indices with derivatives, and the derivatives are going to be symmetric, and so you can't really get anything out of that. Now, one of the assignment problems, so that's good. This is the Lorentz scalar so far, so now we've got a whole bunch of parameters here, but we're thinking we can get rid of those by doing field redefinitions. But part of the story in the scalar case was it was important to know what's real and what's complex here, right? And so the Lagrangian has to be real. So we need to know which of these combinations are real or complex in order to know what the coefficients are, whether they should be real or complex. And so one of the exercises in the homework is these are one of the things that you need to prove yourself once, and then write them down somewhere so you never forget. So the statement is that for two Majorana spinners, things with gamma 5s in them are essentially complex or imaginary, and things without gamma 5s in them are real. So what I'll do is I'll write an I here. And I'm doing that because with that choice, the condition that L be real is the same condition as saying that A, B, C, D, and E are all real. Another thing that we need to worry about is symmetry. So are these symmetric matrices or anti-symmetric matrices? So another part of that assignment is to show you that for Majorana spinners, you can change the order of Majorana spinners, because the complex conjugate in psi bar here, I can think of it as being a transpose, right? It's not, where is it here? Psi bar and psi transpose are the same. So if I give you something like psi 1 transpose matrix psi 2, it's harder to see Lorentz transformation properties if I write it in terms of psi transpose rather than psi bar. But if I write something like this, I can always write that, since these are anti-commuting objects, I can always, you know, if I wrote out the components here, this is psi 1 A, or I guess I, if you think of, I'm labeling here these are the components 1 to 4. I'm just writing out explicitly, M, I, J, psi 2, J. I can change the order of these guys for free, but as long as I put in a sign, because they're anti-commuting fields. So this will be minus psi 2 j mij psi 1 I. And if I think of this as being, if I rewrite this as being m transpose, sorry, m transpose ji, then what I've got here is minus psi 2 transpose m transpose psi 1. So you can see that I can change the order of 1 and 2 in these kind of bilinears for Majorana-Fermions, because there's no distinction between the complex conjugate and the field itself. So that means that all of these terms turn out to have a symmetry property, that if I take these things and I rewrite them the other way around using this Majorana property here, keeping track of what this matrix does as it commutes or anti-commutes through these various gamma matrices in the basis of M's over there, each of these terms is either symmetric or not. And so the assignment is asking you to prove those things too, because those are very useful. So this turns out to be symmetric. This is also symmetric. This is anti-symmetric. It would be anti-symmetric if I had just a second spinner here. But because it's a spinner with derivatives, if I change the order and then integrate by parts, I'll get a sign from the change of order and a sign from the integrating by parts. And so this is, as a tensor, it's anti-symmetric, but it becomes symmetric after integration by parts. I don't know, I'm making that sound obscure, but what all I'm really saying is that the anti-symmetry is the statement that at psi bar A, gamma mu, d mu, psi B is equal to minus d mu, psi B bar, gamma mu, psi A. That's the anti-symmetric part, that minus sign. So if you change the order of these two guys, I get a sign. Because that's true for any pairs of spinners in this matrix, with a gamma matrix in the middle. And so then the statement here is that if I take this Lagrangian, if I think this is something in Lagrangian, I'm integrating it over all space and I integrate by parts, the derivative will then go over this side, but it'll be another sign coming from that, and that'll make it symmetric. And it's the same story here. This thing wants to be symmetric. This is symmetric from the point of view if I just change the order of the two spinners. When I integrate by parts, it becomes anti-symmetric. Symmetric. After integration by parts. So the upshot of that is simple to state. Oops. Bottom line is that A, B and C have to all be symmetric matrices. Symmetric real matrices. And D is anti-symmetric. And E is just real. Now, a useful way to organize this is, what we want to do, so what I want to claim now is that we have enough freedom to redefine fields through linear redefinitions to basically make this into something diagonal with positive entries, to make this vanish, to make this into basically 1 half delta AB, and to make this equal to 0. And much like we did for scalar, for spin 0 fields, and so that the these things will be the masses of the particles, and this is the kinetic term. And we'll have n parameters here describing the masses, and we'll have the vacuum energy, and then those are the physical parameters of the problem. So we can redefine what we want to do, a linear transformation, so we don't ruin the fact that it's quadratic to Lagrangian. And we want to do transformations that don't ruin the fact that these were chosen to be Majorana fields. So we can do linear combinations. So let's say U, A, B, Psi, B. You can also take I, V, A, B, Gamma 5, Psi, B. And this kind of a transformation will preserve the Majorana nature of Psi because of the effect of I put there. U and V are real. So like in the scalar case, we were doing real linear combinations of the scalar fields so that we didn't ruin the reality of the fields. We're doing the same thing here, and the only interesting thing is that we are free to, I'm lying to you there. The statement is, you know, what are we trying to do? Preserving the Majorana nature of these fields is the statement that you're preserving this property. We can do arbitrary linear combinations of this, and this just has to be the complex conjugate of whatever we did up here. And so I think this, what I'm saying here is wrong. This should be, no, I haven't lied to you yet. But, so let's check what we need to do to make this preserve the Majorana property. That is not good. It's really not very well set up for this third blackboard, is it? So what we want to do to follow is follow the left and right-handed pieces, right? So let's look at what happens to the left-handed part of psi under that transformation. It'll go to, so the left-handed projector will take the left-handed piece of this, and it also gives me left-handed piece of this, and the gamma 5 doesn't do anything because, remember, gamma 5, gamma left is equal to gamma left, gamma 5 equal to gamma left, because the left-handed guys are the ones for which the eigenvalue of gamma 5 is 1. I've done the same thing for the right-handed pieces. We've been minus gamma right. So what will happen here will be, for the left-handed piece, we have UAB plus IVAB and gamma left IB. That says I've got a general complex matrix here whose real and imaginary parts are U and V. And if I do the same thing for the right-handed guy using this sign, I'm going to get UAB minus I EAB gamma right IB. And so it is true, so I haven't lied to you, that if I, what we had to demand for this to preserve the Majorana property of psi was that the bottom guys were transforming as the complex conjugates to the top guys. And that's what we've done here, right? So as long as these U's and V's are real, this is a complex conjugate of this. And so we haven't ruined the Majorana property. So this is true. This also shows you that it's useful to think, so we should think, we can call that, you know, say capital U, A, B, gamma left, psi, B. And we can just never think about the right-handed piece because it's just a complex conjugate. And it's useful to think about the left-handed piece alone, knowing that the right-handed piece will go along for the ride. So if we do that here, we should do that for the Lagrangian as well. So rather than writing things as being 1 and gamma 5, what we can do is we can write this in terms of gamma left and gamma right. And so let me do that. So remember, this is not I'm not doing anything mysterious here. Gamma 5 is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Gamma left is 1, 0, 0, 0. Gamma right is 0, 0, 0, 1. So these things make those statements obvious. And, you know, 1 is 1, 0, 0, 1. So I can write gamma 5 also as gamma left minus gamma right. And I can write 1 as gamma left plus gamma right. And so that's useful because that'll allow me to take this Lagrangian and trade the 1s and the gamma 5s for gamma lefts and gamma right. So our Lagrangian then is minus A psi bar A gamma left plus gamma right psi B I B A B psi bar A gamma left minus gamma right psi B So you can see, if I grouped all the gamma lefts, I got minus A plus IB, AB, psi bar A, gamma left psi B. And I've got minus C plus IB, or gamma. And then the rights are just the complex conjugate. So this is plus complex conjugate. So that's just all. I could have written out the gamma right terms, but you can get them equally well by just taking these things, complex conjugate them, and using the complex conjugation properties I told you. I told you anything with a gamma 5 is imaginary. Anything without a gamma 5 is real. And so the complex conjugate of this will change the left to the right. And it'll complex conjugate these guys. That'll change the sign of I. And that'll get you what you would have pulled out from the gamma right terms anyway. And we have minus E. So in terms of, what we'll do is we'll follow the left guys, diagonalize them, and then the right ones will go along for the ride because they're just going to be complex. If we make these things look special, we complex conjugate it, we're going to get something special here too. We don't have to think about them separately. And that's a useful way to think about it because the rotation we're doing is really independent on the left-hand side. So we might as well call curly A plus IB, and curly C will be C plus IB. And so given these properties, A and B were both symmetric. So that means that they were both real symmetric. Curly A will be an arbitrary complex symmetric matrix. Right? And curly C, D is anti-symmetric and real, whereas C is real symmetric. So that means that C is going to be Hermitian, right? Because if I transpose that, this nothing will happen here. I'll get a sign here. But that's the same thing I would have gotten if I'd complex conjugated. So C, Hermitian. Complex Hermitian. All right. Now, so we built in Lorentz invariant. We've built in stability or unitarity by making Lagrangian real. We have to also have stability, so we have to ask for the energy to be positive. And so, let me just tell you that that means that we have to require C to be also positive definite. So this is a separate condition coming from the energy should be bounded from below. All right, so now the bottom line is we do these transformations. We ask how special can we make things? So the first thing we can do is what we did in the scalar case. We want the kinetic terms to look as simple as possible. So we'd like to make this into the matrix 1. Yeah?
Gamma L psi A is equal to U A B, blah, blah, and then psi R is equal to complex conjugate of that.
Yeah.
Isn't that, do we also need E somewhere there?
Oh, yeah, the E will go along for the ride. So if I if I take the complex conjugate of this and then multiply by E, this is not acting in spin space. This is acting only on we have n spinners, and so the matrix E will go right past the matrix the U's. So there's no multiplying by E doesn't change anything. Okay. But the way to get rid of this is to do what we did for the scalar, is we just want to choose our matrix U over there, curly U, to be 1 over the square root of this. And we can do that because its Hermitian is diagonalizable and it has real eigenvalues. And so it made sense for it to be positive definite. The real eigenvalues are in particular positive. And so because it's got positive real eigenvalues, we can take the square root of it and take its inverse. And so we can take, so let's choose, we choose curly U to be curly C and minus 1/2. Then what will happen is that in the new variables, what we'll have is that the Lagrangian will be minus 1/2. Let me put a conventional, there's a conventional factor of a half here that we want to keep, which I didn't write here. So let me put in a half. That would mean that we'd have a half here. And then we'd have delta AB I bar A. Because this is a, after this redefinition, we've made C equals 1, basically. And if C is equal to 1, that means that its real part is 1 and its imaginary part is 0. So that means we've actually removed completely the gamma 5 term, and we've got only the thing without the gamma 5. But then we've got some mess over here for this other term here. So we have minus, we'll have curly, or sorry, it'll be U, I guess U is this, so it's C, it's U transpose A, U, A, B. I guess I want to write here gamma left. Well, you don't have to, actually. So if I added the complex conjugate to this, I would just get this back again. And so I don't need to add I don't need to write the gamma left here. What I've done is I've combined this term and this term, given that C is 1 and D is 0. All right, so we've removed the gamma 5 kinetic term, and we've got the standard form for the usual kinetic term. So now we want to know, can we simplify this? And what we have to do is a transformation which doesn't screw up this. So transformations that preserve kinetic term are ones for which U is unitary. So instead of being a generic matrix, now if we do a unitary transformation, this will always turn into U dagger U, and so that'll just stay 1. So we can use the freedom to make unitary transformations to simplify this. And so then what we want to ask, so if I call this, I'm calling this, let's say the first transformation we did. So this is now a second transformation we're going to do. So let's call this first, the result of the first transformation, we'll call that A twiddle. It's still complex symmetric. And so the question is, after we do a unitary transformation, what will happen is that we're going to take this thing and multiply it by another unitary matrix in the same way. So the Lagrangian will become, it'll be this. And it'll be the same thing. It'll be U2 transpose A twiddle 2. And so the question is, what can you do to a complex symmetric matrix by doing a transformation like that where U is unitary? And so the claim is, and this you should prove, Nobody's saying this A has to be Hermitian or diagonalizable or anything. So this is an arbitrary symmetric complex matrix, which may not be diagonalizable. It could be, you know, the classic example of a non-diagonal matrix is one that's in Jordan form, right? If you had 1, 1, 1, 0, that matrix can't be diagonalized because if it could be diagonalized, its eigenvalues would be 1. Right, because if I take, what's the simplest way to see that? If I take the trace is 2, determinant is 1, so the eigenvalues have to both be 1. But if I could diagonalize it and get both eigenvalues to be 1, I would have the unit matrix. And then if I tried to undiagonalize the unit matrix, nothing ever happens because the similarity transformation on the unit matrix gives me the unit matrix. So this is the classic example of a matrix which cannot be diagonalized. It's not symmetric, so it's not necessarily what we're talking about. But there's nothing that says that this has to be diagonalized in what I'm going to tell you now. It has to be diagonalizable. But it's a theorem which you can prove. Kind of fun to sit down and prove it because it's not one that you normally see in a linear algebra course, but which is nonetheless true. The claim is, you can always choose a unitary U2 such that the transpose complex is equal to diag of positive things. So C1, C2, C3, where all CKs are non-negative. And these CKs are going to turn out to be, this can be done for an arbitrary complex. They're all real, I guess I should have also said. So for any complex symmetric A to it all. And if you go through the construction, which I think, I can't remember if it's in the book or not. It might be an exercise in the book. But the bottom line is that these, the way you construct this thing is if you take the matrix A, twiddle dagger A, that is Hermitian for any complex A. And so that can be diagonalized by, that's diagonalizable because it's Hermitian. It can be diagonalized by unitary transformation. And then these C's are related to the eigenvalues of this, in the sense that this is not only Hermitian; it's positive definite because it's the square of it's like the absolute value of a complex number squared. This is a Hermitian positive def. So its eigenvalues are all non-negative, and its eigenvalues are related to these numbers. So the squares of these numbers are the eigenvalues of A dagger A. But if you had a negative number here, you could change the sign by choosing U appropriately. Just choose U to be a phase. If U was a diagonal matrix full of phases, you can arrange for it to change the sign of anything. If you had found a negative sign here, you could make a new U to be the old one times a matrix which is diagonal with phases, which go through, the phases go through, and they make this thing real and non-negative. So another way of saying that is that once you've accomplished this, by making A real, that means what you've effectively done is you've made B zero and A real. So that means that there's a redefinition that you can do involving the gamma fives. So it's the gamma fives that are making this a little bit counterintuitive, but keeping A, having A be diagonal and real and B be zero means that you've kept the psi bar psi terms have coefficients, which are the usual mass terms. But the psi bar gamma five psi terms, you can all make those zero by doing field redefinition. And you can change the sign of the psi bar psi term by doing field redefinition. And the field redefinition you need is one which involves a gamma five in the redefinition. And that's why you don't see that freedom for scalars. But it is true that if you rotate psi by e to the I gamma five, that's the kind of thing that will change the sign of a coefficient of psi bar psi. And so that's a special case of what we're doing here. So the upshot is that once you're done, L is just minus 1 half delta AB psi bar A m mu psi B. And then I'm going to put in a factor of a half. That's also conventional. Because if I do that, then these C's will, if you ask what the mass is for these particles by looking at their energy, it would have been C over 2. So I just write it out here. So now you see that you've got all the parameters you expected to have. You've got one a mass, and you've got a vacuum energy. So the counting is just like it was for spin zero particles. And this is, you know, if you had only one of these things, you would have had this is what you call D slash gamma mu B mu. That was supposed to be mu. And this is what you would have called the Dirac Lagrangian. The message there is that it's a slightly different algebra, but the moral is the same, that you can, there's a very general thing you can, there's a much more general thing you can write down as Lagrangian than the standard Dirac Lagrangian. But most of the extra things in that Lagrangian you can remove by doing field redefinitions. And so that means they can't be playing any physical role. If you had kept this Lagrangian and calculated anything physical, you could do it. You could use these variables. You'd work much harder. But you'd always be finding that there's only n plus 1 things in your predictions, n plus 1 combinations of these parameters were ever appearing anywhere. And those were the ones that were the masses and the vacuum energy. So this canonical choice, so this is the canonical choice. It's canonical. The 1 half is canonical for Majorana fermions. For Dirac fermions, you normally would not have the canonical 1 half there. And the word canonical is coming from when you write psi in terms of the creation annihilation operators the way that I did in the first board, which I might have erased now, and you just do canonical quantization. So you take the momenta and you ask for the momentum with the fields to have a quantization condition, which is, you know, the anticommute to H bar. And then you ask what that means for the creation annihilation operators, the way I've been normalizing all the fields. Find the standard creation annihilation operator algebra if you start from this canonical normalization. If you started from something more random, when you work your way down to the creation annihilation operator algebra, you have some of these factors are appearing in that algebra. So what's canonical about this is that all your intuition and the things you're used to doing, which are based on that creation annihilation operator algebra, are guaranteed for you if you just do canonical quantization for this field, and same thing for the scalar fields. And for spin a half, spin one fields, I won't do it in detail because I think you guys get the point now. But there's a similar story. So for n massless spin one particles, three particles, we would have similarly, in principle, been able to write down minus 1/4 some matrix, you know, ZAB, FA mu nu, FB mu nu, where A goes, A and B go from 1 to N. And for each of them, F mu nu is the curl of something. And positivity, you know, the reality of Lagrangian, we say these Zs are real. It's symmetric because this is symmetric under A goes to B. So Z is a symmetric real matrix. We can redefine these fields to make Z delta AB if we want. So. And redefine the A's. And that's the canonical choice that you normally see. And with that choice, you know, then the A mu, which would have been the sum over the polarizations, integral D3P of the square root of two pi cubed times twice the energy, this polarization vector P lambda these would satisfy the canonical commutation relations with this canonical choice, yada, yada, yada. And these would be the polarization vectors which satisfy, you know, P mu, epsilon mu equals zero. All the usual things that you have for QED would apply here. And of course, these things are not vectors. The under Lorentz transformations, A mu goes to, you know, lambda mu, I guess nu mu, A nu, plus the gradient of something. And so combining this into a Lorentz scalar will only really give you something which is Lorentz invariant if you've also made it invariant under shifts under A goes to A plus the gradient, which is the gauge invariant requirement. And of course, F, the reason F is appearing here in the derivative terms is that it's the thing which is invariant under that shift because of the antisymmetry in the definition. Right. Any questions for that? So that's free field beaten to death. And we haven't used them for anything, but your assignment uses them for something. And
some scalars and some things, other cross terms or anything like that are quadratic.
In principle, there could be, yeah. So yeah. You're thinking of things like A mu, B mu, phi, or something like that.
Yeah,
you could get. So if those are there, normally when those are there, you can redefine them away. As I know you know.
Yeah.
And that's something which is because this is really the only one that, for the fields we're talking about, this is the only one that works like that. And whenever this happens, the constraints of the gauge invariance, the fact that A has to be invariant under shifts of gradients, constrains the kinds of things you get like this. And so it guarantees that there's a gauge that you can choose which gets rid of these. So you can always do a redefinition in that case, which corresponds to a particular gauge choice, which kills these terms too. But as you have more and more complicated background fields, you can get into the places where you do get mixings among spins, and I don't know if there's a general statement that you're always guaranteed to get rid of things if you have a very not symmetric background. So let's do that. So what I'd like to do now before we go into the example, because I want to cut the loops at some point. So we need some interactions. And so what I want to do is write down a poor man's notion of renormalizability. I want to show you that for these, if you have n, you know, scalar fields and a different n, you know, so a whole bunch of scalar fields, a whole bunch of spin a half fields, a whole bunch of spin one fields, and you put them all together, there's really not a whole bunch of things you can do, not a whole bunch of interactions you can write down that are renormalizable in this poor man's sense that I use in the assignment. So in the sense that on dimensional grounds, the couplings are always positive or they're never negative powers of mass. So that's the last thing I want to do today is to work that through and show you that there's really a small number of interactions you're always talking about and into which fall all the interesting theories that we really know describe nature that don't involve gravity. And those will be the ones for which we'll be looking at loops with a couple of exceptions, but mostly just these. All right, so interactions. So we've got a free piece with an interacting piece, and kind of by definition, these are the things that were cubic and higher in the fields. And what I want to do is I want to follow, so L interaction, you know, it could involve things like we could have had, say, three scalar fields. Or we could have had maybe four scalar fields. Or we could have had scalar fields and fermions, say. We could have had something like Y, A, B, I bar A, gamma left psi b psi I plus complex conjugate A. Or we could have, you know, you can imagine writing down 15 scalar fields, let's do it. H I J K L M. We could have had something with. I just want to have two straw men here. A B I J, A B C D I J. So we could have had something like psi bar A, gamma left psi B, psi bar C, gamma right psi D. And maybe we could put in a derivative somewhere, or maybe gamma mu, d mu, phi I, phi j, or lots of things you can imagine writing down. And the point I want to make now is that as you write more and more complicated things down, dimensional analysis tells you that these coefficients have dimensions which involve more and more negative powers of mass. So if you're interested in theories for which you have couplings, these are the couplings, which only involve non-negative powers of mass, you're restricted in how many fields you can write down. And so there's only going to be actually these three things you can write down if you don't have spin one particles. So let me make that argument. Those will be the things that are the renormalizable theories. So the good thing is that there's not many of them. And the other good thing is that those are the ones that are the easiest to predict with. And we're going to want to know at some point why, you know, nature should choose to work with those theories. And that's something which we can come back to. But first, let's just say what they are. So what we want to do is we want to find dimensional analysis dictates some properties of these couplings, some properties of the couplings. Their dimension. So how do we proceed here? So the basic thing is we know the dimensions of the Lagrangian, because we know the Lagrangian, the action is the integral d4x of the Lagrangian d, because it's the integral of the Lagrangian over time, and the Lagrangian was the integral over space of the Lagrangian density. And so if we use units where c is equal to 1 and h bar is equal to 1, then the action, you know, has units of h bar, because h bar, you know, e to the I action over h bar is what appears in path integral, if you like, but the action and h bar have the same units, and so the action is dimensionless in these units where h bar is 1. With these units, everything can be thought of as a mass, or everything can be thought of as a length, or everything can be thought of as an energy. Mass to some power. So length, you can get from length to time using the fact that C is putting in the right factors of C. Well, that means if you give me something which has dimensions that's not mass, I can multiply it by the right power of H bar and C to make it into a mass. And that's what those are the units we're using, essentially. So in those units, this is dimensionless. It's mass to the 0 because it's h bar is 1. This is length cubed times time. So, you know, length in these units becomes the same as time, because time and length are just differ by factors of c, which are 1. And they're basically 1 over mass. And energy is mass, because they just differ by factors of c. The h bar, this is coming about because if you remember, momentum is h bar over length. And so if h bar is 1, that means length and mass are 1 over each other, or momentum 1 over each other, and then you can get from momentum to mass using c's. So this is length times time, length cubed times time, which is going to be 1 over mass to the 4th power. So that means that L has to have dimensions of mass to the 4th power. If we'd been in d dimensions, this would have been mass to the dth power. And that's kind of one of the ways in which different dimensions would differ from one another. So with those conventions, the the fact that we've got our fields in the canonical, so now let's go to the free part of the Lagrangian. We just described what the canonical form is, and that'll tell us the dimensions of our fields. Because what we know is that this is now mass, we know that this has to be mass to the fourth in dimensional, on dimensional grounds. And what our goal is we want to know what the dimensions are of these coupling constants. So if we know what the dimensions of the fields are, and we, since we know what the derivatives are 1 over length, so those will be masses, we can figure out the mass of these, the dimensions of these coupling constants once we know the fields. So to get the fields, we need to go to the free part of the Lagrangian for which we've removed all the parameters except for the actually physical masses. So when, once we've canonically normalized everybody, the fields will have a specific dimension. So L naught for spin zero particles would have been minus 1/2, you know, delta ij d mu phi I d mu phi j minus 1/2 m squared I phi j phi I j. That was the free part for the spin 1/2. We just did the spin 1, which was spin 1/2. So this is spin 0, and now spin 1/2 is this. So the kinetic terms are the ones that have no parameters left, right? So we can read off from the kinetic terms what the dimensions of the fields are, because we know that this Lagrangian is mass to the fourth. So derivatives, you know, this is always length or time. Length of time is 1 over mass, so 1 over length of time is what a derivative is, and that'll have to be positive, that'll be mass, essentially. So you can see that you've got a factor of mass here, factor of mass here. So that means the scalars have to each, if they were each mass, then we would have mass to the fourth. That says that the II for scalar field should be mass, have dimensions of mass in four dimensions. If we've been doing this in D dimensions, the Lagrangian was mass to the D, so this would have been mass to the D. This argument wouldn't change, but you'd need to have mass to the D minus 2 over 2. In higher dimensions. So you can see that in higher dimensions, fields have a larger mass dimension than they do in four dimensions. In two dimensions, if we've been looking in two dimensions, this is mass squared. We already have the mass squared here, so the fields would have been dimensionless. And so the conclusions we're going to draw about renormalizability and how hard it is to get couplings which have powers of positive or that don't have powers of inverse powers of mass, the statements I'm making will change in different dimensions, and you can follow through that change just by keeping track of the dimensions of the fields. And typically things are more, less renormalizable for higher dimensions and more renormalizable for lower dimensions because of this change of dimension. All right, same story here. We got one derivative here. So that means that this has to be mass of the 3/2. And we can check the mass terms now. So if this has dimensions of mass, and that has dimensions of mass, this should be mass squared. That's what it was. That was this coefficient was the mass squared. And this combination together will be mass cubed given this, and that has dimensions of mass. So the masses have dimensions of mass, which is always a good sign. So with that choice, we can go through here. Now we can read off the dimensions of these couplings. So if these guys are masses, then to get mass to the fourth, it has to be true that G IJK is also a mass. If these guys are all masses and there's four of them, then you already have the dimensions you need, so these lambdas should be dimensionless. Something with five powers of pi's here, like this one, now you've got too many powers of mass here. This has to be 1 over mass to make the dimensions work. So H I J K L M 1 over mass. And you can kind of see that the more powers of fields you have, the more negative a power of mass you have to have in the coefficient, because the fields all have positive powers of mass. And derivatives all have positive powers of mass. So the things you're building your Lagrangian out of all have positive powers of mass. And the only thing that can give you negative powers are these coefficients. And so that's kind of more or less the logic. But the more derivatives and fields you have in your interaction, the more negative a power of mass the coefficient has to be on dimensional grounds. Similarly here, we have two fermions and a scalar. So something like this, this is what you would call a Yukawa coupling. Two fermions and a scalar, and no derivatives. So that's a mass. Two fermions is a mass cubed. So altogether, that's mass to the fourth. And so now y is dimensionless. If we had had two scalars, say, and two fermions, then you could see that we'd have mass cubed, mass squared is mass to the fifth, and the coefficient would be one over mass. And so that would be an inverse power of mass. So something like this, you can see, you know, K, A, B, C, D, I, J. We get mass cubed is mass to the sixth. And then we have two scalars is mass to the eighth, and a derivative is mass to the ninth. So this would have to be one over mass to the fifth. So a poor man's renormalized theory. Well, I should ask. We talked about alternate classes last time. And one question I had was, on Fridays, it's sometimes true that they don't have a seminar at 11. And if that were true, and if we were to run for another half an hour, is that a problem for anyone? Does anyone have something happening right after this class? In Guelph, do you have a problem if not today, but occasionally if we run late on Fridays, is that a problem?
No.
Okay, because that's another way in which we can make up time if we have to at some point. So I'll make a note of that. So is one for which two properties hold. The first property is no couplings have a dimension of negative powers of mass. The second property is all possible couplings consistent with symmetries are written down. So there's no reason for you to understand why this is what renormalized, this is actually going to be what renormalized really means. But there's no reason why that should be clear yet, because I haven't even told you what renormalizable means. But there's a class of theories we're heading towards, which are very predictive and include the ones that we describe nature with. And for now, I want to define them to be theories for which the coupling constants involved never have negative dimensions of mass. So you would have this would be okay, this is okay, this is okay, this is not okay, this is not okay. And essentially, if all we have are spin zero and spin one half particles, you should convince yourself that the only things we can have are these three things: cubic interactions, quartic interactions for the scalars, Yukawa couplings, and that's it. Second thing is you can't say have this guy and not these guys. You have to write down everything that's possible with consistent with your symmetries. You can restrict things with symmetries, but that's the only restriction you're allowed to make. And the reason for that is that quantum corrections, as you'll see, will generate them if you didn't have them already. And we're going to want to be able to, then they'll diverge. And so you want to be able to absorb the divergences into coefficients. So you have to have all interactions that are possible with this first criterion. Now the last thing I want to leave you with is the same statement for spin one. Oh. Well, that's a shame. All right, for spin one particles as well. There we want to write a Lagrangian which involves scalar fields, spin a half field, and then also these gauge fields. But we want to do it in such a way where we have the symmetry, A goes to A plus D A. And a D A, yeah, D omega, let's say. And I'm not going to try and write down the most general one. Let's just write down electromagnetic one for the purposes of the assignment. And the question will be, so we know that the kinetic term for the gauge field will be this one with Z at delta AB. We could have a bunch of these guys. Let's say we have psi I and psi A, but let's say we only have one gauge field for a massless spin one particle. The trick is we want to know how to couple this guy to these guys in a way which preserves this property, which is required if we're going to keep things Lorentz invariant. One way to go would be to try and build interactions only using F, because then we're guaranteed that we have the invariance of the shift. But if you go through the exercise and try and write down what's possible, you'll see that there's nothing you can write down which is renormalizable in the sense I just defined. So first claim is that there's no renormalizable couplings between A mu and phi A and phi I and psi A using only F mu nu. And for example, if we had taken something like psi bar, gamma mu, nu, psi, F mu nu, that's something we could have done with some coefficient kappa AB. This has dimensions of mass cubed. But F has dimensions of mass squared because A, you know, the Lagrangian was F squared. So the Lagrangian is mass to the fourth, so F is mass squared. A is mass, just like the scalar field was, because the derivative of A is mass squared. And so that's mass squared, that's mass cubed. This has to be 1 over mass. And so this would not be renormalizable. You can write those things down, that's a magnetic moment interaction. But whatever they are, they're not renormalizable in the sense that we're describing. So if you're going to couple these things in a way which is renormalizable, you don't have the option of only using just F. You have to somehow incorporate an interaction between A and these other things which preserves this property. And so there's a question is how you do that. And maybe the thing is to pick that up next time. Let me write down the answer that you need for the assignment. And then the next class can come to why it's true. So the claim is that you can do what you want to do, can be renormalizable and invariant. A goes to A mu, B mu omega. If phi and psi also transform, so if L is also invariant, under delta phi, I is I omega, some matrix I j. Delta phi left. So the thing is, you can choose these t's appropriately. And essentially, what you're doing is you're choosing there to be symmetries in the matter sector. And you're asking that these fields transform under those symmetries at the same time A transforms. And so if you do that, then the statement that the L is invariant implies that it implies several things. You know, if you just actually ask delta L is derivative with respect to A times d mu A, times delta A nu with respect to the derivative delta So if I just go through Lagrangian and its derivatives, I guess I have the derivative of L respect to the derivative of phi I, delta the derivative of phi I. So what that'll give me is that if I just do this, I want this thing to be zero. This is the statement that the Lagrangian is invariant under this transformation done simultaneously. If I plug this, and this into here, 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 and here, I get a whole bunch of conditions on the Lagrangian. So what you get is, so let me do the first ones here. You can kind of see that, so delta A nu was just this. So we would have had 0 is equal to dl dA nu times d mu omega. We have dl d mu A nu times d mu d nu omega. And then we would have had dl d phi I times I t I j phi j. And we would have had dl d partial mu phi I. If I differentiate this transformation rule for phi, I'm going to get a term where I differentiate phi. I'll get a term where I also differentiate omega, and that can't be zero because, you know, we omega had to have derivatives that were allowed. So we'll get a term which is, I forgot the omega. It'll be I t I j d mu phi j omega plus I t I j phi j d mu omega, and so on. And so what you do now is you want to group the terms involving omega undifferentiated, the terms involving one derivative of omega, terms involving two derivatives of omega. And that leads you to a bunch of conditions. And they have to all separately vanish because the derivatives of omega are all independent things if omega is an arbitrary function. So the coefficient of omega will just be this things involving the matter fields. And it basically is going to be the requirement that the Lagrangian be invariant under this transformation. The matter part of Lagrangian without the gauge field has to be invariant under this by itself. So that'll say that L matter with A mu equals 0 is invariant under star, where this is star, for constant omega. So that's just a regular symmetry now because it wasn't differentiated. The coefficient of D mu omega, say that the derivative of L with respect to A, so 0 has to be equal to the derivative of L with respect to A. And there's another term over here involving, there's a derivative of omega here, right? So we'll have dl d phi. So that has to be equal to 0. There's also a fermionic base, please. That's fermions. This is telling you is that this is saying that everywhere you have a derivative with respect to phi, you have to also be getting an A in a Picker combination. And so this is the solution to this condition will be that everywhere you see d mu phi I in your Lagrangian, you should instead think of write d mu phi I, the combination d mu phi I minus I t I j a mu phi j. So this is the covariant derivative. So it says that every place you have an ordinary derivative, you have to really have a covariant derivative. And that'll be the condition that makes these things zero. And same thing for the fermions. And the things that are appearing in the covariant derivative are the same things that were in your transformation rules. And then the thing with two derivatives, the only place that gives you that, since we have a first order action, is this term here. And so that says that, this term here. So since this is symmetric under mu nu, this will vanish as long as this is anti-symmetric under mu goes to nu. And so that just says that dl d mu a nu has to be equal to minus dl d nu a mu. And that just says that whenever you see a derivative of a, it has to always appear in the combination of f b nu. So d mu a always enters as f b nu. So I've ended up doing most of it. But so the missing step was the thing that you might not have been obvious is that you needed to promote the symmetry to act also on these other fermions on the matter fields. But once you do, the requirement that the Lagrangian be invariant under this, which you require for Lorentz invariance, is the thing that is essentially the gauge invariance criterion that you're always using. And it says that everywhere you have a derivative of the fields, they have to appear in gauge covariant combinations, the gauge covariant derivative or the field strength. And so let me close off with what I wanted to do was write down the Lagrangian that you need for the assignment. So scalar QED is a case of one complex scalar plus one massless spin one. So we have a, let's call it phi, a mu. And so our Lagrangian will be minus 1/4 f mu nu. So that's the free part for the gauge, the spin one particle. And we'll have minus one. We won't write the half because it's complex. And so what I'm thinking is that phi is really 1/√2 of the real part plus I, the imaginary part. And if we use this in the Lagrangian I'm going to write down, we would get the canonical kinetic terms that we wrote before with the factors of half. But I won't do that, all right? So this is going to be d mu phi complex conjugate d mu phi, because I needed a kinetic term. But the rule was if anything with derivatives, I had to really use some covariant derivative instead. And then I'll have also a mass. So here, f mu nu is the usual thing. And the covariant derivative is partial mu phi minus I e a mu phi. If we'd written this in terms of the real and imaginary parts, what this would have amounted to, because of the factor of I here, would have been a rotation in the 2x2 if you had a phi real and phi imaginary. If we had done an orthogonal 2x2 rotation, like cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta, that rotation is what this symmetry, that's the symmetry we the infinitesimal version of this would have been delta phi, or phi I would be, you know, 0 omega minus omega 0 phi R phi I. And so this is with the matrix I've been calling T over in that definition over there. But when you what's nice about complex fields is that it's very simple to write this matrix just as a phase. And so there's no matrix that appeared here. But you could have written everything in terms of real scalars with this combination. And the kinetic terms would have looked exactly like the ones we've talked about. The mass term would have become phi 1 squared, sorry, no half. Phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared, or phi real squared plus phi magic squared. And the half would have come from this. And that would have given us a mass term that we had canonically. And these are the parameters of the theory. This is the electric, the charge, and the mass. So the assignment asks you to calculate phi photon scattering. Because you know you said that you're happy to get Feynman rules from Lagrangian and calculate the cross section, and this is just to go through the exercise of doing it with the conventions that I'm using. You could have put one there, but I chose not to, yeah. So you could have had a phi star phi. Sorry? Yeah, no, so if the rules, so if the, actually do I? No, you're right, I probably should have written that down. So, because the rules for renormalizability were that we wanted to write down things with only non-negative powers of mass dimension couplings, and everything allowed by the symmetries. And your point is that this is allowed by the symmetries. This is a dimensionless coefficient, so it should have been there. Yeah, so there's no reason why you couldn't have written it down. And you have to write it down. In the assignment, I write it down. It doesn't play a role in the thing you're gonna calculate, but you're right that it should be there. Sorry, I ran late there, more than I wanted to. So So where I would like to go next week is, unless there's questions of this, is to just take ordinary QED, which is the, instead of having scalars here, we'd have fermions, like an electron, and calculate, just explicitly calculate some loop processes like the vacuum polarization and the self-energies. They're a little bit more complicated than the reason that your assignment is scalars is that scalars are easier when you do the calculation. Real compton scattering is actually a pain in the ass to calculate, but this one is not so bad. So we'll do the loops for the scalar, for the QED case, and they actually have physical implications. They're the things that appear in the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, and in the Lamb shift, and all these classic tests of QED. And in doing that, that'll raise a whole bunch of issues. There's just the evaluating of loops involves, you know, you'll have to regularize the loops, and you want to do it in a way which preserves the symmetries. There's various tricks where you're trying to write the integrals in a way which is convenient to work with. And along the way, once you identify the divergences, you're going to want to know what to do with them. But it's easiest to see those things all in a concrete example. So the plan is to just do a vacuum polarization in QED and then hit these things as we get to them and deal with them, you know, as they arise. But you'll see as they arise that there's very general things that we're doing every time. And this particular example is just chosen because it's not the simplest example, but it's the one that really has, you care about the answer. It's something which is testable. All right, so I won't see you next week, but the class will be held next week, so come usual time, and pick it up there.